This is Lewis Lapham with The World in Time. My guest is Barbara Clark Smith, curator of political history at the Smithsonian National Museum of American History in Washington. She is speaking with us today about the freedoms won and lost in the American Revolution. The story that is usually told, Barbara, is about the liberties that we won, but your new book comes with the title, The Freedoms We Lost. What were those freedoms and where did they go?
I'm speaking specifically here about the ideas about liberty that ordinary middling men had. I'm not talking so much about the founding fathers, the famous men that everyone's heard of, although they're certainly in the book because they're involved in the revolution. But I'm not so much interested in the leaders as the followers. Think about ordinary farmers, ordinary artisans or tradesmen in the cities, everyone from goldsmiths to shoemakers. Think of small shopkeepers and storekeepers and dealers. I'm interested in what they thought about liberty.
You divide it in two parts, what they think about liberty. And part one of your book is the years 1750s, 60s, and 70s, and then after 1780.
Yes, that's right. They go into the revolution and join and make the revolution with those elite founding fathers that are so famous, with certain ideas of what they expect and what they want, certain ideas of what they're defending. And then they end up in a quite different situation. On one level, that shouldn't surprise us. You go into a revolution, 20 years later, you come out with something different from what you thought you were going to get. That's true for all the participants in the revolution. Some of the things were real gains.
Let's talk about what the common ground was among the artificers and shopkeepers and so forth, what they thought liberty was going into the revolution.
There were two key parts to liberty, according to the ordinary farmers and tradesmen and kind of middling people. One was they were accustomed to forms of participation that later Americans wouldn't enjoy. I'm speaking here of the kinds of free white men who qualified for the vote, which meant they owned some property, some little farm, enough tools in a shop, so they could vote for a representative to their colonial legislature. But they also participated in a way that we don't participate. They participated as jurors in common law courts. And when they did that, they expected to be able to make their own local notions of what was right and fair felt in the law. We have to think of serving on a jury less as something that was just a big waste of time, although sometimes it probably felt that way to them, but also as an arena where they could make political choices about whether the law that the king had passed and the judge was trying to enforce, whether that law actually applied in the locality. So one thing that they considered essential to British liberty was this form of consent or participation in execution of the law, not just in passing the law by voting for people who would write the law, but in executing the law, in seeing whether it worked out and how it worked out in a particular court case, in a particular county or a particular town or neighborhood in the colonies. That's one of the freedoms that they assumed was part of British freedom. And when they saw that violated by the Stamp Act and the Sugar Act and the Tea Act, all these laws that were supposed to be enforced not in courts with juries, but in admiralty courts, which were separate courts just with judges, they objected to that. So they were not simply saying no taxation without representation, although they certainly believed that. They also believed there should be no execution of the law without the participation of people in the neighborhood where the alleged crimes had been taking place.
So the power really rested with the people rather than with their representatives. Extend that thought with what you mean by out of doors. What other kinds of powers were outside a courtroom?
The term out of doors, the people out of doors or the people outside, meant the people outside the representative body. And they used that term in England to talk about people outside of Parliament. And they used that in the colonies to talk about people outside the representatives. So just the ordinary people who would never aspire themselves to be rulers or representatives. They operated as voters, They operated as members of juries. They operated as spectators at courtrooms because the whole courtroom procedure was public. And they operated as spectators at public punishments. They didn't put people in penitentiaries so much in those days. If you were convicted of a crime, they did sometimes fine you and you had to pay a fine. But they also had the public punishments such as standing in the stocks, standing on the gallows with the rope around your neck for a certain period of time, and then ultimately, of course, was public execution. And those two were extensions of what went on in the courtrooms. And the people who gathered on those occasions had, in some ways, the same kinds of power that the governors had. That is, the governor could always step in last minute and issue a pardon or reprieve. If it were a really unpopular situation where someone was being sentenced to execution whom the whole community felt was actually innocent or had a good reason for what they did, there could be a rescue. The crowds of people would go and interrupt the execution. Now, that didn't happen all that often. It only has to happen once in a while for every judge and every governor to know that it might happen and therefore to change their own decisions accordingly. Because the worst thing that could happen from their point of view was that they try to conduct an execution, they try to establish what they consider justice, and the whole community disagrees. Then the authority is really shaken by that. So it's much better if you're the governor or you're the judge and you can see that there's a very strong local opinion to decide to be particularly merciful in one case or decide that this is worthy of a reprieve, because that way your authority isn't shown to be something everyone disagrees with in the whole community.
So they have the power of executing laws. They have the power of the police in some way. What power do they have to regulate behavior?
Well, this is the other side of that. Not only can they let off people who the government thinks are guilty, but they can do the opposite. They can punish people who haven't, in fact, been convicted of a crime or indicted of crimes. And this behavior is sometimes very strongly disapproved of by people in power, but not always. And it depends how disruptive it is. Crowds of people might go in the city like Boston, might go and shut down brothels. Brothels, of course, are illegal, but the law doesn't say the way to end it is to have crowds knock down the houses and chase everyone out. However, if they see that the government isn't supporting that law, isn't executing that law, the people may decide to execute that law. They form crowds and act against men who beat their wives or wives who beat their husbands. They form crowds and rescue individuals accused of crime, or they prevent sheriffs from foreclosing on property when they feel that the individual in question has been hardworking and hasn't been given a fair shake, and really this foreclosure on the mortgage isn't fair. These are in neighborhoods where people knew each other and they knew each other's work habits and abilities, and they were often intermarried and related and members of the same churches, and so they felt able to put the judgment of the community, broadly speaking, into effect as if it were law. And frequently it was in some ways law. That is one example. There were laws against monopolizing goods, buying up a lot of necessary goods, and then raising the prices too high. And if government didn't execute those laws, then crowds of people might execute those laws. They might break into warehouses and sell goods at a reasonable price. The main item in all those crowds and riots where people were enforcing laws tended to be bread or grain, because that was the staple that poor people really depended on to live. So if there was a merchant or a baker who was not marketing grain or charging too much or waiting for the price to go up, you might get a crowd executing the law against monopoly in necessary goods. They would go and seize the goods, and frequently they would pay the owner what they thought was a reasonable price. So they really didn't act as if they were simply robbing the person. They were very clear they were acting as executors of the law.
You talk about the colonies being perceived as a neighborhood writ large, and the people therefore can enforce some kind of behavior that mitigates the ruthlessness of the free market, the idea of individual profit superseding all other values is not one that was in force in the colonies.
That's right. And that may be the one biggest misunderstanding that Americans have today about liberty in the colonial and revolutionary era. We know that they thought that government being oppressive, government making too many rules, government trying to take your property without your consent, that that was oppressive. We know that. But they also thought that it was oppressive when individual private interests tried to take your property or force you to pay prices that were too high or fail to pay you wages that are reasonable given what the cost of bread was. And they supported government. They were not simply anti-government. You can find Samuel Adams, one of the major patriots of the Revolution, in his Boston newspaper writes specifically that it's oppressive when government lacks the power to protect the people and promote their prosperity.
What does the word patriot mean in this decade of the 70s? A friend of the people, a person who shares with his neighbors? What do we mean by the word patriot?
Well, I think primarily what they meant in the decade from, say, 1765, the time of the Stamp Act, through 1776, when independence was declared, was putting the good of your neighbors and the region and the colonies as a whole before your own private profit or even your own personal ideas about many things. It was joining with other people. It was joining together in particular with neighbors in non-consumption and non-importation agreements. And these agreements or pacts, we all know them, that people agreed not to drink tea and people agreed not to buy imported cloth and instead they would produce themselves and the wealthy would buy from their producing neighbors. Instead of buying from British merchants and British manufacturers, they would buy from American farm households and American artisan households. So that would help all the middling people get out of debt and stay out of debt, and it would lift the whole community together. Everyone who counted as a patriot agreed, we won't import, we won't consume certain goods, we won't raise prices on goods when they become very scarce due to our agreement, and we will only deal with other people who have joined the movement. So they formed this economic and social movement, which I call the patriot economy, because they're creating a network or a system in which people deal with one another according to shared notions of what's fair and what's best for the country as a whole. And that's the way that they imagine themselves as a country. Before this, they had thought of themselves as all these separate colonies, not necessarily with too much in common, but they begin to cooperate and they find they agree on certain basic political principles and they find they agree on what neighbors should do, how neighbors treat each other, certain basic values about not simply profiting if it means that your neighbor goes under.
So there's also an agreement between the rich and the poor. In other words, many of the founders, the people we read about, were rich planters, merchants, plantation owners, people of real property who had a taste for conspicuous consumption. But if they were going to be patriots, they had to modify their extravagance.
They had to put aside a lot of the trappings of their elite status. For example, the representatives in Maryland gather together wearing only homespun and leather garments that were made in the colonies. Instead of looking fashionable and wealthy, they are dressing down to show their solidarity with the ordinary voters. And they need to carry that out in many aspects of their lives. They have to stop drinking imported wines and they have to stop going to expensive theaters and plays, and they have to stop going to expensive funerals, and they have to attend much more austere occasions and show that they don't want to bring their country or their countrymen into debt. The line between the patriots among these elites and the loyalists or the Tories was really drawn by whether or not you showed primary loyalty to the people who are below you on the social scale. The men we honor as founding fathers, in my book, what was great about them was that they were willing to throw in their lot with the more ordinary middling planters and farmers and tradesmen. And they were willing to support the values of those people. And they agreed that they should have a society where people cooperated and government worked for the good of the majority of those middling people, not for the few lords and aristocrats who wanted to own all of the land or wanted to live in great wealth, but for the broad number of free people.
It's the health and well-being of the body politic as a whole, as opposed to the ruthless ambition of the single individual.
There's a great suspicion of the individual's ambition, and there's certainly ambivalence about it among the founders, but the ordinary farmers, their view was you should aim at what they called a competence or a competency, meaning making enough for your household to be supported and maybe enough to have some extra conveniences and occasionally nice things. You wanted enough to pass on to your kids so that your sons and daughters would end up in independent households like yours. But they really condemned people who were guilty of what they called boundless avarice, by which they meant the great men who already had money, were friends of the powerful, and wanted more and more and more and more. The idea that everyone individually seeking his own profit would work out best for everyone, that idea was not at all popular. That wasn't what they were thinking. They were thinking that you have to put limits, and you particularly have to put limits on the great men who are good friends with the people in power.
The freedom they enjoy is the freedom from under the weight of money or under the weight of boundless avarice.
I think that's how they think of it. After all, you have to remember they came from England, and the experience in England was one of large landlords and landholders gathering more and more property and pushing out the small holders, so that you ended up in England with a system with large lords and landlords, some middling yeoman farmers, but many, many more families who were either pushed off the land and worked in manufactories for where they made woolens and other things, or ended up going to London and trying to make it there, or ended up as wage laborers on somebody else's farm.
What happens to these liberties, this common ground, this kind of liberty, after 1780? How does it get reflected or lost in the writing of the Constitution?
Well, things shift tremendously. And of course, there are great gains in freedom made in this time period. Many more men can vote afterwards than before. And most important, of course, they're electing not just the representatives, but directly or indirectly upper houses or senates, and also executives or governors, and eventually, of course, in the federal system, the Congress and the president. So there is that gain. But what goes with that gain is the loss of the use of a jury as a way to make local and common notions of what's fair felt. Juries shift. What happens in the courtroom is the people are no longer represented by a jury. They get represented by the prosecutor, the district attorney, so that in a case of law, it wouldn't be Rex or the king versus Smith if I were accused of a crime. It would be the people versus Smith. So in that situation, jurors lose certain rights. They gain more rights as voters, but they have fewer rights as jurors. And then the second thing that happens is that many issues that were very important to them became identified as economic issues. And those were either moved from the state government, things like the power to emit money or to coin coinage. That was moved to a central government, farther away from the voters' ability to influence. And also there was a new notion of freedom, which was the freedom of even extremely wealthy and privileged individuals to make as much money as they could and to override what had been shared and common ideas of right and fairness in localities. So they also lose a kind of purchase on daily economic exchanges that they had assumed was part of life before the revolution.
And do they lose the notion of neighborliness.
Well, that notion certainly continues on for a long time, and I think most generations feel it's declined, and it certainly declines as we end up in a more global world. Although the idea is very resilient, and I think even today you'll find Americans who think that we should be making decisions according to what's fair and what's right, and not according simply to what the market determines. But that's really not the position of the government and of the majority. So the ideas of neighborliness continue, but they're increasingly seen as irrelevant to what government should be doing.
Thank you, Barbara Clark Smith, for speaking with us today about freedoms won and lost in the American Revolution. I'm Lewis Lapham of Lapham's Quarterly for Bloomberg News. Copyright Bloomberg 2011.